rules are designed to make something happen the same time every time. But that's the last thing you want in any creative activity. So rule of thirds, for instance. If everyone did it, it would be really boring, wouldn't it? So it's a bit of a tightrope to walk if you're writing about this and trying to help people. On the one hand, you say, look, if you do this, certain things will happen in the mind of the viewer, or in your own mind and looking at it, it may just look more comfortable. But maybe you want to be a bit different. Maybe you want to be a bit edgy. It's good, you know, you can do what you like.
Hey, welcome to the Beginner Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Raymond Hadfield, and today we are chatting with travel photographer and longtime educator Michael Freeman about developing your photographic eye. But first, the Beginner Photography Podcast is brought to you by CloudSpot. Impress your clients with a beautiful gallery that is easy to view, share, and download on any device. You can control image size, add watermarks, and download limits. So grab your free forever account at deliverphotos.com and only upgrade when you're ready. Michael Freeman has written 70 books on photography, and his book, The Photographer's Eye, is consistently one of the most popular books for photographers on Amazon. Michael is not only very well versed in many areas of photography, but also I think his ability to use words to describe and teach visual concepts is truly incredible. Michael has been shooting for a long time, and therefore he's seen a lot of changes. So there's a few things that he mentions that if, you know, maybe you're not familiar with film photography, you might not fully understand. So, the word negs is short for negatives. And negative is the film that was actually in your camera in the film days. They're called negatives because the light and the color are inverted. So you would have to reverse the image to get accurate color and light when printing the photos. He also talks about transparency film as well, which is the exact opposite. Film that captures accurate light and color. So transparency film is what they used in things like slide projectors and whatnot. They're two very different films for two very different use cases. So hopefully that that fills you in on a bit of the conversation there. Those are the two main ones. But I know that you're going to enjoy this one if you stick around. So with that, let's go ahead and get on into today's interview with Michael Freeman. Michael, I want to know, when did you first know that photography was going to play an important role in your life?
It wasn't a sudden moment. It happened gradually. This is a very long time ago. In the 1960s, right? And in those days, you generally didn't do whatever you wanted. You didn't have gap years, and you did what you were told. And basically, at school, I was told I should apply to Oxford or Cambridge, and I did. So I went to Oxford, and when I left Oxford, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I studied geography, which, you know, was fun, but it didn't want to become a geography teacher. And I went into advertising. Advertising at that time was very fashionable. In fact, I joined Central London. I joined a New York agency, one of the biggest at the time. And it was the British operation to keep big clients like Procter & Gamble and General Foods and IBM happy. It was fun, but I got bored at the end. Or sort of frustrated, really. The work was interesting for a while, but at the time, I'd always wanted to take photographs, but also I'd always wanted to write. So, I mean, for me, it was a case of something like feature journalism was a vague ambition, but that wasn't on the cards. It wasn't a proper job. When I was at Oxford, I spent more time working on the university newspaper than I did on the course. But journalism was not seen as serious. I know that sounds strange, but it wasn't a proper career. So I'd done my duty because everyone told me to. But in the end, I decided I really needed to get out and do something. And it was, so it was then after a few years in advertising. And I escaped by taking a sabbatical. Again, it's a different era. It was, just wouldn't be possible now. But my boss, two times higher, he took a sabbatical and went around the world with his champagne heiress wife to visit old friends around the world. And I thought, that sounds a pretty good idea. But what I'd always wanted to do was go up the Amazon. Sort of at school, it was either going to be the sort of thing we talked about. It was either we're either going to be a stock rider in Queensland or we'd be an adventurer up the Amazon. So, many years later, I decided, right. So I said, I want a sabbatical too for 2.5 months. And they said, okay, fine. That means they pay you and they just wait for you to come back, sort of like maternity leave. And, so I bought some secondhand cameras, Hasselblads, from a guy in the media department, and I took a plane to South America and wandered around. So it was very irresponsible, but that was the way I got myself committed to getting out.
So I appreciate you sharing that. I think that a lot of people can resonate starting, going to school for something to learn it, get into that career, and then decide later on that they want to switch. But had photography been in your life before this point? Because it sounded like you were in school, you were interested in the journalism, but like, where did the idea for capturing your trip to the Amazon on photos come from? Because, you know, in my head, it's, how great would it be just to go and experience those things? You know, very few people actually think to themselves, let's take a camera, and especially Hasselblads. So like, where did this idea of the importance of photography come from? Was it at an early age?
I really don't know the answer to that, despite the fact I've had plenty of time to think about it. But gradually from an early age, to me, photography was a kind of magic. Just the idea that you could capture a moment, not that my early moments were particularly special, was there's some magic to it, something that was beyond logic. Mm-hmm. And I had the ability to make interesting looking images, so ones that I thought were interesting. So it became gradually a real interest and then a need.
So when you're in the Amazon, you have these Hasselblads. There's no auto mode. There's no aperture priority. There's nothing. It's, these things are full manual, right?
No autofocus, right?
Yeah, nothing. So how did those photos turn out?
That was normal. You know, that was normal.
No, of course.
When autofocus came out, we used to joke about it. You say, what? You know, if you can't focus the lens anyway, you shouldn't be a photographer. Why would you need autofocus? You work with what you've got in anything in life, particularly anything that involves any kind of technology. So we didn't know anything better than that.
Sure.
And these Hasselblads, first of all, I got a really good deal. Yeah. And then I got another one from a Swedish client, and he wanted a rubber dinghy. And so we arranged that we'd do a swap, so basically I had this super wide, which is a compact little Hasselblad. And it cost me £125. Let's say $160.
No.
Yeah, it did. And, you know, I still use it. I came back to using it a couple of years ago. So now I travel with it. And it's a beautiful, I don't know. There's, you know, cameras and equipment are they're a tricky thing in photography, because it's evident that too many people spend too much time going on about it. You only have to go to any sort of photography fair just to see, oh, God, it's ridiculous, you know? But nevertheless, so we always like to say, hey, it's just a tool, okay? But nevertheless, every serious photographer I've ever known pays a great deal of attention to the equipment. So there's this sort of ambivalent relationship between something that it's what you use. So you have to love it and take good care of it, but you have to think, shall we say, through the viewfinder, not twiddling knobs.
Sure, sure. Having the knowledge that you have today, you've had a long career in photography. If you think back to those first photos that you took in the Amazon, right? Like, this was kind of your first attempt at really trying to make something interesting, artistic. What would you say about those photos? Where were they lacking as compared to where you are today? If you're ready to turn your lens towards a profitable future, but are unsure how to stand out in a competitive market, well, then I've got just the solution for you. I'm thrilled to offer you exclusive access to our free video training called Maximizing Mini Sessions. It's put on by the legendary duo Philip and Eileen Bloom. This video webinar is designed specifically for photographers like you who are eager to learn the art of effective marketing and promotion and who want to start earning money with your camera. This isn't about just taking great photos. It's about making sure the right people see them. Discover the power of mini sessions, the secret of promoting them, not just to get noticed, but to truly stand out. Learn the best timing and tactics to catch your audience's eye and get them in front of the camera. So if marketing has been your stumbling block, then wait no more. Visit beginnerphotopod.com/mini to sign up for your free video training now. It's time to put your photography in the spotlight where it belongs.
Wow. Well, there's two views. One is, how did they look at the time? And I was surprised. There was quite a number of good ones that I liked. And in the end, actually, that's the only thing that matters. And even if your eye and your judgment isn't fully developed, it doesn't matter. I mean, it will, or it'll move somewhere. But you've got to have, they've got to please you. And obviously, the more you come to know about photography, about the world of photography, your place in it, what other people do, then if you're paying attention, your judgment will get better and you'll be more critical and hopefully improve. But I still have a few of those pictures which I think it's still a good picture.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, it was partly an escape, a real escape, a sort of trying to escape an area that I'd found I'd got myself into that I didn't see it as a really interesting future. And then it was partly experimenting. So both those counts came out pretty well.
Were those photos the catalyst for you to say, you know what, maybe I'm not going to go back after my sabbatical? Or what was your work history after that? How'd you?
Yeah, yes. I mean, it certainly took some time, but I had some luck. I hawked them around. The funny thing was that, so I'd still live in central London. Because I had no idea what to do, I sort of did things that you wouldn't normally do. Like I rang up the Brazilian embassy and spoke to the cultural attaché and said, look, I've got some nice pictures of the Amazon. And he said, really nice man. And he said, great, actually, that's just what we're looking for. Because, you know, we've been doing all this sort of economic stuff and it'd be nice to have something, you know, a bit more sort of appealing visually. And he put on an exhibition.
Wow.
Yeah. And he had and this is in central London in Mayfair. And then he had a guest list and he invited, among other people, the picture editor of the Daily Telegraph magazine. And this is when weekend supplements were new and hot. Yeah. The guy came, right? So he gave me work. And then there were two senior editors from Time Life who were setting up London Edit at the time to do book series. And they came and they said, oh, can we borrow the pictures? You know? So actually it took it took quite a bit of time because I went back to work, but I was still, you know, playing around. And a few months later, I got a call from the picture editor of Time Life, and she said, "Would you like to come along and see what we're doing with your pictures?" So, I'd more or less forgotten about it. So after work, I went along, and she said, "Well, I didn't call you before because we change our minds a lot." Was that ever true?
What does that
mean? But this is her. So she showed me, and I had the cover of the first book in the series, in the Wild Places series.
Oh, no kidding.
I had double trucks. I had a chapter opener. And when I went home on the bus that evening, I thought, that's the best encouragement I'm ever going to get. Mm. Because no art directors at the agency said, "Michael, what are you wasting your time for? You need to be a photographer." Nobody said that. So the next day I resigned. Again, a different era. And the agency gave me a leaving present of 2 weeks' work for a major client as a photographer.
What?
It was a tough world. Yeah. This was late Mad Men era, right? It was a tough world, but it was decent. No?
That's incredible. So, yeah. So then, okay.
Oh,
so
yes, the pictures were okay.
Yeah, obviously, yeah. Doesn't get much better than that. So then how do you transition from just taking photos into, because now you've written, how many books? How many books on photography have you written?
Oh, on photography, 70.
17 books on photography.
70, 7-0. 7-0.
7-0. So
how many books altogether? 157.
So how do you get to that point? At what point do you say, you know what, taking photos is great, but I actually want to share this knowledge with others? How did you get there?
No, you don't get there. That's not regular progress. It's something on the side. I do it because I enjoy doing it.
The sharing part, the writing part? Is that what you're referring
to?
Yeah.
And I like books. I like putting books together. So what happened was, after quite a number of years, but still not enough to be actually knowledgeable, I had a good relationship with this publisher, and they said, "Look, we want to do a book about photography. Do you do it? You can do it." So yeah, I'll do it. So I did it. And it turned out pretty well, and I think in the end, it sold 750,000 copies. That's not to do with the excellence of the writing so much as the sales. I mean, you know, that books, particularly illustrated books, where the margins are very small, as are the percentage royalties, incidentally. We're not talking about novels here. There's a big structure of marketing and sales and foreign rights. And that's really, you've got to be with, you know, good company. That's the way it works.
So I got to say, Michael, you have a number of books. Like, you've been, I think when I transitioned out of cinematography into photography, of course, you know, that was the thing I did. I went to libraries, went to, Amazon to look for books. Like, your name has always been, for me, in the top, you know, five books on Amazon on photography.
Hey, who are the other four?
I don't remember who they are.
No. I don't want the answer to that. Yeah. Don't be late.
You were right there at the top, for sure.
Yeah, thank you.
So I guess one, I want to know, like, why do you think that is? Like, why do you think your books resonate with people so well that they continue to buy books, that they recommend these books to others? And then two, how does that influence you going forward when you make new books? Are you ready to transform your love for photography into profit? Imagine capturing beautiful moments while bringing in a little extra money for your family each month. Sound too good to be true? With CloudSpot, it's not just a dream. Designed by photographers for photographers, CloudSpot simplifies your business. Effortlessly organize shoots, send professional contracts, questionnaires, invoices, and enjoy faster payment payouts with the lowest fees in the industry, including PayPal. Forget lost emails and messy spreadsheets. CloudSpot offers a streamlined workflow, letting you focus on the moment. And here is the clincher. Grab your free CloudSpot account at deliverphotos.com, and you'll get access to my personal wedding and portrait contracts and questionnaires. So don't let uncertainty hold you back. Embrace the future of photography business management with CloudSpot Studio. Sign up at deliverphotos.com today and transform your passion into profit.
Well, on the first, I'd like to think, because I do think about the writing a lot, that it's because there's no bullshit. I mean, I really try and avoid that. I also try and avoid writing stuff that's been written by other people before. Why would you want to do that? I mean, unfortunately, now on social media, you can see endless stuff churned out, cut and pasted. What's the point? It's not interesting. So I've always tried to write in a way like conversation. In other words, direct to, I mean, I like, should we say, literature?
Yeah.
And I appreciate good writing. I like to talk directly to the other person as an intelligent, interested person who's interested in this. So when you write books about, should we say, how-to books in some way, then it's important, I think, to not to talk down, not to waffle. Sorry, that's probably not an American word, but not to just
ramble
just
on. Sing,
yeah. Just ramble on, yeah. And it's important to all the time have an idea. I mean, the only words that are worth writing are stuff that comes from your head, not regurgitated from somewhere else. Otherwise, what's the point? So I always had a kind of analytical mind, and I realized that that's a bit unusual for visual artists, because most people are either visual or they write.
Yes.
There's only a few that sort of manage to bring them together. So that's how I hope it works.
What's interesting is that, like, when you have a lifetime's worth of experience in something, and this is something that I struggle with, is that I, for some reason, believe that everybody knows what I know. So it's hard for me to kind of talk about something to somebody else because I don't know where they're at, and I just assume that they know what I know. So what do I have to share for them? But for you to have created the amount of information that you have on photography for photographers, that's a big thing, and you continue to do it in such a high quality way. To say that, like, you're just polite about it, like, I really think that you continue to put in a ton of work, because your latest book on black and white, I have a question about that, because you had just said there, you're like, I'm not going to write about what other people have written about. And there's a million other books on black and white. So is it a perspective thing that you mean, that you don't want to talk about what everybody else has talked about?
Well, I try not to. I want to talk about the things that I find interesting. And it's often about ideas. So aesthetically, black and white's really, really interesting, because it was photography until two things happened. Color film became widely available, and magazines started printing in color. The two things went together. And interestingly, what I've been thinking about this more recently is that the color that we shot, so when I started, basically, was the early 70s. And that was just the time when color was what everyone wanted editorially. And what we all shot was transparency film. Nobody shot negs.
Yeah.
The reason nobody shot negs editorially, well, a few people did, but they were just being difficult, is that you can't edit negatives. So, I mean, my life in photography has been very, particularly because I was in advertising, I didn't want to go back into advertising. I wanted a more glamorous life, which was shooting for magazines and traveling the world and doing picture stories. So, of course, I became very familiar with the magazine editorial world. And I'm talking about, so, you know, picture stories rather than to manage studio shoots. Okay. It's the reportage. So what that meant, and every magazine, Time Life, books, Smithsonian, Geographic, Sunday Times, you had a picture room. In the picture room, around the side with the walls where you pinned up the layouts, which were always in black and white, right? In the middle was a large table. No seats, everyone stood. So it's a big table. And it was a light table. So we had this large glowing table and stacks of slides. And, you know, people would slide them across, like that. And what it meant was it's a different way of shooting altogether. So what I'm getting around rather lengthily point is that the shooting meant it stopped the minute you pressed that shutter release. You didn't do anything else to it. It came back. When you came back from a trip, a bike came, you got a bike, a delivery bike, and they took all the rolls and they brought them back later in the day. And that was it. You'd shot what you'd shot. So, of course, color transparencies then segue into digital in the early part of this century, yeah, around the early 2000s. But what happened? So what happened then was that, so you have three periods of photography. You have black and white only. Then, at least in my world, then there was color, where very rigid, all about the shot. And now you can do anything with it.
Meaning digital?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can anticipate, and you've got raw files, and obviously nothing was much good in like 2003, but now the phone, for heaven's sake.
Right.
It's 50 megapixel.
It's wild.
Pro raw images. There's a ton of information in there. So black and white, where did black and white fit into this? So black and white, instead of being what everyone did, because that was all there was, to being elective. Black and white is now something you do because you want to do it. And it's a different route back to this early idea of photography.
Yeah.
And I find that really interesting because in the very early days, well, obviously there were many notable photographers who did heroic work in the darkroom and knew when they were shooting what they could do with it. I mean, you just look at anything about Eugene Smith. I never met him, but he was certainly a hero of mine. And he had his own ideas about what you do. I mean, he kind of fooled around, if you like. I mean, you wouldn't get past the door of World Press Photo these days.
No kidding.
But the idea was you took a shot knowing that you'd be doing something with that shot. You knew how you wanted it to be. So the negative was really just one step.
Do you as a show called The Beginner Photography Podcast, there's a lot of listeners today who are brand new to photography. And this world is still very new to them. And there's a big push to like record in RAW, have all of the data possible, and then you can explore all the possibilities after the fact. Right, within editing.
Well, it's absolutely true. That's not what I like to do.
Yeah.
Look, the photography has room for everyone in it. And there's lots of kinds of photography that I really don't like.
Yeah.
But I appreciate that people do it because they like it. So it's not for me to say you shouldn't do that. No, people do what they like. But my idea has always been, and it's all of this is very much connected with personality. So my idea, probably informed by the fact that I've been 50 years a professional, is that you should know what you're doing from the start. Yeah. Okay. There are always going to be surprises, and some of them will be lucky surprises. But I'm not a fan of saying, well, let's just take a picture, any picture, and then we just go and work on it in the dark room and make it nice.
Yeah.
I don't think so. To me, you should be thinking when you're taking the picture, when you're planning to take a picture, all the way through. So my view of modern digital photography is that the process of photography stretches from preparing to shoot, depending on what kind of shooting you're doing, but being aware of in the street, being alert to possibilities, not to the point of pressing the button, but to the final delivery, whether it's a print or it's on screen. And the good processing or printing, the idea is to do the best for a good photograph anyway, but to bring out the best qualities, the ones that you were hoping for. So it becomes a stretched out process, but it's still a process that begins with the idea of, that's an interesting picture. That can be a picture, whichever kind of shooting you do.
How do we get there, though? How do we get there? How do we get from, I don't know how to use this camera, I'm just hoping for the best, hopefully I'll press this shutter enough that I'll get a photo that I like, to you see the photo in your head before you take the photo and you know exactly how it's going to turn out? How do we get there?
The technology is, it gets better all the time and easier all the time. So the camera will do it by default. It will give you a workable picture. There's now these things called autofocus, newfangled ideas. So you'll get a picture. So that's less of a problem. There shouldn't be any kind of, what do I do with this? You pick it up and shoot. Phones. I mean, that's another thing. I love my Hasselblad. This is the real future.
The phone.
It doesn't have to be in a phone, but it's got to. But it's something that is extremely easy to use. It's with you all the time. And what that should be doing is making you less concerned about the fiddly bits, and more concerned about, what do you see? What's interesting? That's really why, about 15 years ago, I decided I wanted to write a book about composition, because, to be honest, almost no one had. It seemed a bit weird to me.
Yeah.
Now, also, I know my professional community, and it's one of the things that photographers really don't like talking about. But organizing the stuff in the frame, framing it, that's something that you don't need, all the technicalities to do. You got a frame, and the camera that surrounds it, they do now, can take that picture. That's what becomes one of the most important things. Assuming you've already got an idea that, or whether it's, I'm going to shoot in the street today, I'm going to see them, get a picture of this person, make some interactions or whatever, then it's very much, to a large extent, it's about how you identify the things you're going to photograph, call them subjects, and how you organize them in the frame.
That's a hard thing, though.
Is it a hard thing?
I think it's a hard thing for new photographers to understand, because they've taken photos all their lives. They've taken photos all their lives and never thought about anything like the background or where to place their subject within the frame. They're just pointing and shooting. So now that we have this tool where we can control these things, it becomes an additional layer, right? As you said, like, not only do we have to figure out all these fiddly bits, but now also we have to figure out, like, what's in the frame. So,
well, I would say you strip out the rest. That becomes easier, and concentrate on that. Well, the other part of this, of learning how to do this, is extremely, there's two parts to it. There's something to reject and avoid at all costs, and that's people telling you what makes a good composition. I do try very hard to say not to put too much judgment into this. And I absolutely insist that in any creative activity, whether it's writing, playing music, or photography, that the whole idea of a set of rules is anathema, right? We're not doing engineering here. We're not building a bridge. So rules are designed to make something happen the same time, every time. And in engineering, you really do need that. But that's the last thing you want in any creative activity. No? So rule of thirds, for instance. Mm-hmm. If everyone did it, it would be really boring, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, it's that kind of thing. I mean, you know all this. So it's a bit of a tightrope to walk if you're writing about this and trying to help people. On the one hand, you say, look, if you do this, certain things will happen in the mind of the viewer, or in your own mind and looking at it, it may just look more comfortable, the arrangement. But maybe you want to be a bit different. Maybe you want to be a bit edgy and do stuff, you know, that some people are not going to like. Or maybe most people aren't going to like, but it's going to make, you can do what you like. You know? That's my problem is suggesting, but trying to avoid dictating.
Of course.
Anyway, that's the negative side. That's the side you have to reject. The side to embrace is... It's really one of the simplest things in the world, and every professional photographer I know does it all the time, is to look at other people's photographs. Mm. I mean, I don't know a photographer who, within his or her area, doesn't know who the greats are.
Sure.
The greats from the past, the ones coming up, they know, because the more you absorb, the more you're able to form an opinion. You're saying, well, I like that. That's good. I like what that guy does. So then you say, okay, fine. Just look at what that guy does or did. What makes you hang together? Why do I like? So anyone can do that. And that's why, in my view, we're all beginners. We should all be beginners. In the sense that, yes, accumulate all the knowledge, all the ideas, all the opinions, but the minute you start to think you know it, you're lost. You have to, even at my age, I have to try and surprise myself, because otherwise it's not going to be very interesting. Mm. I mean, who wants to go out and take pictures that they've planned already? I mean, I find that really kind of boring.
Sure.
I mean, commercially, but... there are always surprises, because they don't come when you want, and they, you know, like London buses, they probably come two or three at a time, and then there's not another one by half an hour. But you have to be open to the surprises. You can do this as a beginner or somebody who's experienced. Anyone can do it, right? Mm-hmm. We're all used to looking at screens, at pictures, at movies. Oh, we've been cinematographer. I mean, it's a different way of putting images together, but some cinematographers or directors have a kind of eye that is more similar to a still photographer's sure. eye. Stanley Kubrick, for example, another of my heroes. So, and you can see from the way that many of his frames are set up that they're what a photographer would do, a still photographer would mm-hmm. do. That, I think, is very important, is to study pictures made by people, and you can make it easier for yourself. The ones that are well-known, okay, that's a good start, right? Because if they're notable, in my terminology, then at least you're not going to be wasting your time looking.
Yeah. Do you have any tricks for looking at somebody else's work and not falling into the trap of comparing yourself? Because that's a big issue today with just the amount of photos that we can consume. Have you heard that this
if
is
a good, you know, if it's a good photograph, a good photographer, you're going to find it quite difficult to take pictures like that. And there's a tradition in art, in painting, which goes all the way back in Western art, in Chinese art, where you learn by copying the masters. Mm. Now, it's rather different with painting, because you could take your time, you've got it there, but you learn how the strokes go. And you practice that until you kind of got into it. So there's a lot, it's very common now to say, oh, you shouldn't copy, da, da, da. It's damn hard to copy a good picture.
Yeah.
Good photograph. Very hard. Mm. Now, what you can do, of course, is set your sights very low. And a lot of people do this now on picture sharing social media, and they do a very genre-specific kind of picture, say, neutral density waterscapes.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I mean, I find these very interesting to look at. Well, interesting. No, I find it philosophically interesting, because when they were new, when only a few people had done these, they were interesting, right? But with volume, they all look the same. The problem is that if you set your sights low and aim for a very technique-focused kind of photography, then the work's all going to look the same or very similar. So the technique will overwhelm the personality of the photographer.
The technique will overwhelm the personality of the photographer. So to avoid that from happening, we need to introduce more of our personality.
Well, avoid the low-hanging fruit, basically, and aim for something a little bit more special, or more where you have more feeling about it. This is not a foolproof solution, but the thing that always helps is really having a very sound knowledge of the world of photography. And you can't go to enough exhibitions. There's plenty of sites on the internet to go and look at what people are doing, whether it's a survey of one photographer's past work. So it's not that hard to find good photographers within the areas that you enjoy, which might be reportage, it might be street photography, it might be fashion. The good people are known. Mm-hmm. So if you take your time to look, I mean, I do it. Where do I look? Okay. I like looking at the Magnum website, for example. There's no bad Magnum photographers, really. And then a huge number of photographers in that history.
Yeah. You know?
I look at lens culture. I'm not plugging them. It's just that they're not quite as easy to look through as they used to be. But and the another one is, well, all magazines have, they've got some kind of photo section, right? So if you like, I mean, National Geographic, they have a lot of, social media
of course.
Presence.
Yeah.
Life magazine now. You know, if you go on to Google, is it Google Books? I can't remember. There's some deal where you can download every issue of Life magazine.
Really?
Including the ads. Yeah.
Wow.
You can look through everything right from the very start. Yeah. I think it's Google Books does it. And then also there are these aggregated gallery and auction sites like artsy.net. And what these people do is they aggregate galleries from around the world and auctions, right? So you just type in the name of the photographer and it'll show you all the stuff.
Really?
And who's selling it? Yeah. So I wanted to look at, I've got this up on the screen here. I'm interested in certain periods of history. So I'm looking here at Alexander Rodchenko, who was Russian, very geometric, unusual angles. So he's got a picture from 1935.
So when you go on sites like this, you go on to, are you using it to explore and open up your mind of different photographers, or dive deeper into one photographer's work?
Well, both. I mean, you know, I'll kind of like, I have an idea. I'll go and look at Rodchenko. Not good. I remember one or two things he's done, but I want to see what else he did.
I see. I see. I like that idea. Yeah. I like that idea a lot.
And this is all black and white that I'm looking at, incidentally.
Yeah. It sounds to me like when it comes to learning photography, one of the most important things is to just immerse yourself in the technical details, to learn the tool as much as possible. No, go on. I was wrong there.
Well, yeah, but how long is that going to take?
Right. No, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it could, technically it could take forever, you know?
It's not the most important thing. You need to be competent. Absolutely. And also, depending on the kind of work you do, then obviously you're always learning. I spent a lifetime doing mainly reportage. I also do studio work, but mainly reportage. And there you really have to be alert. Mm-hmm. And it means your camera, and that, this goes back to the days of film, right? Your camera has to be really an extension of your hand. And the more you use it, the less you have to think about it.
Sure, sure.
But so it's of course it's essential, but it's a kind of, that's taken as understood that you will be learning how to operate the machine and gradually getting better and better. But that is not what is going to improve your photography. It'll help you get a picture fast enough so that you catch the moment before it's over. But behind all this is much more important is what you think is going to make a good picture. Mm-hmm. And again, there's room for everyone here. It might be that you're really, what really interested is the expression on people's faces or gestures. Or it may be you're interested in the pure graphics of a picture.
That's what's so hard about photography. There's so much. It's all over the place. So for you, let's say you had to, this is going to sound super cliche, I guess, but if you had to tell a brand new photographer how to be successful as a photographer, maybe not commercially or, you know, anything like that, but from personal.
How to satisfy themselves.
How to satisfy themselves. Yeah. What would you tell them?
Well, it's not a single thing. It's not a secret of the universe answer. It's a continuing process. So first understand there are no magic bullets in photography. Why? If there were, it wouldn't be worth doing. Mm-hmm. So you have to commit yourself. You have to learn to form an opinion about what's good and what's not, what's interesting. So you have to, on the one hand, keep practicing with the equipment, learn how it works, learn how to use it seamlessly. Right, you have to immerse yourself in the world of photography to know what the people who are in your world, you're part of that world of photography, whether that's like some wildlife photography or street or something like that, what they're doing. You need to know where the bar is on every kind of photography, and you have to do it. You've got to go out and do it. Or you may have to go in and do it if you're in the studio.
Of course. But practice is key, yeah.
And also realizing every kind of worthwhile photography, whether it's in the studio and managed by a team of people to an inch of its death, there's always small surprises, and there can be big surprises. If a picture is entirely predictable, it's not going to be that interesting. It may be what the client needs, but, you know, I don't do fashion photography. And for that reason, I'm interested in fashion photography, in looking at it. And you can see where some moment has happened or some gesture, or the photographer said, hey, why don't we just do that? Change the lighting here or that. And it becomes a little bit more special. And maybe it becomes more special.
I see.
If you do those things, you're on the way. You're on the journey.
And that's all that we can hope for. That's perfect.
Yeah.
Well, Michael, we're at the end of our time. I cannot believe how fast this time went. For those listening who are thinking to themselves, this was great. I want to learn more about this world of photography. I want to learn more about Michael and what he's doing. Where's the best place for us to find you online?
Google, I guess.
So candid.
Yeah. All right. Type in Google or go to Amazon and type in Michael Freeman.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of the Beginner Photography Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it with a friend. Start a conversation. Grow together. That is it for this week. Remember, the more that you shoot today, the better of a photographer you will be tomorrow. Talk soon.
Thank you for listening to the Beginner Photography Podcast. Keep shooting, and we'll see you next week.